Welcome to the Car Sim and Race Driver Show with me, Hugh Hattrick. Now, this week we learned of the passing of Andrew Cowan, which really is a tragedy, and our thoughts and prayers go out to his wife, Linda Cowan, and to all the family and friends. Now, Andrew Cowan had an incredible rallying career. He won the London to Sydney Rally twice and was the head of Mitsubishi in its most successful years, just to name a couple of examples. So I thought I would put out the interview I did just over a year ago with Andrew as he talks and gives his incredible history for your enjoyment. So it's to all his friends and family. We hope you enjoy this podcast. Thank you. Hello, you're listening to the Cardo Advisor podcast with me, Hugh Hattrick, and my very special guest, Andrew Cowan. Hello, Andrew. Thank you very much for coming on the show. How are you today?
I'm very well, Hugh. Thank you very much. And enjoying my retirement.
Yeah.
I've been robotic for a while.
Yes, well, a few weeks ago I was speaking to Douglas Niven, and he had mentioned, of course, different people in the borders with our great motor racing heritage. And, of course, I remember you from many years ago with doing being the head of Mitsubishi and, of course, doing all of your rallying in different parts of the world. So I thought today it would be fantastic to just to ask you a few questions about your rallying history and how you got involved and things like that. And our listeners, they always come back to me saying, my goodness, there must be something in the water in the Berwickshire, because there's so many motor racing legends like your good self, you know, who have done so well here from Berwickshire. But so we'll go straight in. And what was the thing that really kind of got you into motor racing and rallying?
Well, I think that you mentioned Berwickshire. I think Berwickshire was most important because the Berwickshire District Motor Club was a very active motor club, mainly farmers and also wine merchants and various startups and agricultural dealers, Jocko Bay and them. They formed this Berwick District Motor Club, and we had two World War II airfield training vehicles, Winfield and Charter Hall.
That's right,
And they brought motorsport into the borders, and that strengthened the Berwick District Motor Club. And if you were a young farmer, you were a member of the Berwick Motor Club.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I was actually at Charter Hall yesterday. I went and drove round, and I thought, I've not been there for years. And when I actually went near the old airstrip, there was a military jet doing a flyover. So they must have been practicing on the old runway.
Well, they have a circuit here from Germany. They come. St. Tab's Head, they've got a radar beacon. Then over Charter Hall and back over here.
I suddenly thought, I better not park on the airfield just in case it's about to land, you know.
Well, it's really nothing to do with motorsport. These guys are
So did you race at Charter Hall then as well, or did you more at that time?
Yes, I started. My first rally car really was a Volkswagen Beetle, but I didn't do anything except the events locally with that. Uh-huh. Then I had Sunbeam Rapier.
Yeah.
My father said to me, I'll buy you one car. He couldn't afford to go rallying, but, he was a member of Berwick Motor Club, and he would attend the film shows and the winter programs, indoors usually.
Yeah.
And he bought it. He said, whatever you want, if you damage it, you're finished.
Right.
So I got my Sunbeam Rapier, and I raced that at Charter Hall. But in those days, it was, you could race any car. You know, they ran, like when Jim Clark raced the DKW, and in a handicap race.
And he
was sitting on a grid with Lotuses and D-type Jaguars, and all these things.
Yeah.
There was the little DKW, but it was a handicap race. And they set you off.
After some time.
The DKW would be, if the handicapping had worked perfect, you would all cross the line, the finish line.
Yeah, together.
But that was the type of racing we had available to us, so you could get involved.
So did you meet lots of other racing drivers as well when Charter Hall was quite active?
Well, yes. I mean, we met on the international events. We met lots of names that have probably long gone, but You know, I remember the names well, but we supported the event very well because they were being run by our motor club.
Yeah, because I'd heard that Jack Brabham had raced at Charter Hall.
Oh, yeah, Jack Brabham.
And Stirling Moss. And
Stirling Moss, all of them. I remember them. Prince Bira, He was one international. The BRM cars ran at Charter Hall.
That's amazing.
All of these international guys were part of the scene.
Yeah. So as things progressed, you said you got a contract to drive. It was at Sunbeam Rapiers and then Hillman Imps, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, what happened was that I couldn't afford racing cars and only rallying. So I was using the Sunbeam Rapier, which was probably as good a rally car as you could buy at that time.
Yeah.
And a lot of the rallies were done on the roads around here with a fantastic network of roads and the borders here, and a good organisation from the Berwick and District Motor Club.
Yeah.
And, we rallied around here, and what happened with me was that there was a Scottish Rally Championship, but I found that English press didn't write much about the Scottish Rally Championship or the championship events.
Yeah.
It was all about the English events down in the south and in Wales and these places. So I thought, well, I'm not going to waste my money doing Scottish rallies, whereas I could go down south, down to Kent, down to Devon, Wales, and Yorkshire, and they would say, who's this Scotsman that's coming down and running rallies for the Scottish?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but at least I've got publicity. We're talking now about the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, but I won the Scottish rally, the Scottish International Rally, which was the number one rally in Scotland. In 62 and 63 in the Sunbeam Rapier, and Roots Group, who were manufacturers of the Rapier, they were running cars in the Scottish Rally, and I beat them and won the rally. So I got a bit of a got noticed really with them, and in 63 they asked me to join the team.
Excellent.
The team at that time was competing in Monte Carlo, the Alpine, the Tulip, and the RAC Rally, all these big international rallies. So they had three drivers, and one was Peter Proctor.
Oh, yes.
Who turned out for them to be a great friend of mine, and he was badly burned at an accident in Goodwood.
Yeah.
But anyway, Peter was in the team, and he was caught for speeding in Falkirk on the Scottish Rally.
Yeah.
And he lost his license.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So it meant that he couldn't do the Alpine Rally in the works car.
Right.
So that opened the door for me in the works. They invited me to drive his car in the Alpine. But unfortunately, he appealed against this charge, and they gave him back his license, and it was going to court.
Oh,
and I lost my drive.
Oh, right. Oh, no.
So my first drive for the works for the team was 1964 Monte Carlo Rally in a Hillman Imp.
Wow.
And that was the first time an imp had ever been rallied. We did Monte Carlo Rally. I don't know where we finished, but it wasn't very high up.
Yeah.
We started from Oslo to Monte Carlo.
Yeah. It must be an amazing experience, though, to drive on these incredible European rallies and then end up in Monte Carlo and just to be part of that whole setup and experience it all.
Well, it was. And I hadn't driven, I'd once been over on the continent. I did the Tulip Rally as a private entry of my Sunbeam Rapier.
Yeah.
So I had a wee bit of a feel for it. But, it was amazing in those days. It didn't seem to trouble us.
Yeah.
We go into Monte Carlo. Well, we started that year from Oslo.
Yeah.
We put the car in the boat at Newcastle and sailed to Oslo, and we started the rally there and drove down through, across to Denmark, down through France, to Monte Carlo, and it didn't seem to trouble us, we were country folk. We came from the bush, as they would say in Australia, and we were competing against people that had done it for years. What to expect.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. know, we just did it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember my father telling me of, he would drive for, you know, without a stop from Edinburgh, or from the borders right the way to the south of France, because he used to love going to the south of France, and never thought anything more of it. And of course you just had maps, that was it, didn't it? You know, I suppose you knew the area if you'd been there a few times, but that was it. You just drive and drive until you got where you wanted to go.
Well, we did that, and I must admit, in those days, quite different from today, you didn't get rest. There was no rest period.
Well, I suppose that's it, yeah.
So we were always very fit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we didn't have many other things to socialise.
Mm.
Didn't go to the pubs. We didn't misbehave like some people do, I suppose, nowadays. But we were very fit because we were working.
Aye, on the farm and things. Yeah.
It was really. It was really not a big effort.
Yeah, to do
to
it.
To face up to some of these adventures.
Absolutely. And then I suppose you're not just driving on normal roads or dirt roads, but you're driving as fast as you can on these roads. I mean, I suppose that from someone, what is the kind of attitude you have when you're in a rally car and you're driving? I mean, is it like 90% commitment all the time, or is it, you know, is there a kind of safe net that you have that you think you have to run in, or did you find you were going absolutely flat out everywhere?
Oh no, there's no. If you drove at 90%, you weren't going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was flat out everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, if you didn't go, then you weren't competitive, and you weren't going to get into get a result.
Yeah.
So it was always flat out, and when we were doing these rallies on the continent, the roads were closed to the public.
And
that was new to us. When we were rallying in the UK, they weren't closed to the public.
Goodness me, that sounds incredible.
The RDC rally wasn't closed to the public.
Really?
Like
that. That's incredibly dangerous, because people could join a road if you run it.
1963, we moved into the forests.
Right, I see.
UK,
yeah.
And they were closed to the public.
Yeah.
And the special stages, as they were in the forest,
were
door handles, you know, you're absolutely on the limit all the time.
Yeah.
It was a good learning curve, you know, being able to do that and being able to, you know, set your car up for a corner, although we had no practice, no pace notes.
Really?
It was just what you could see.
Goodness.
And, it was good fun.
Yeah. I don't think when you see these classic interior clips of like the rallying in the old, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and you do think it's incredible because the cars don't have the, you know, all the roll cages and all the strength that they do nowadays, and yet you were absolutely flying through these forest roads, and it must have been quite thrilling, as well as, like, I suppose you're concentrating so much at the time, but when you think about it, after you'd won an event or done very well at an event, it must have been hard to sleep afterwards thinking about the excitement you've had in that day.
Well, the Britain and the RDC rally, Scottish rally, and these special stage rallies in the forest, they were the last rallies to run blind.
Yeah.
I mean, all the continental rallies, the Acropolis, all these rallies, you were allowed to practice them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen me in practicing for Monte Carlo for 3-4 weeks.
Yeah.
And writing pace notes, and the co-driver read the pace note back to you.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big, big difference from doing a rally in the UK. The continental people and the FIA finally made it a rule that you must be able to practice.
So
they do today, they practice for the RDC.
I think it's just starting, isn't it?
But you drive over the stage once, and the co-driver makes the pace notes describing the road.
Yeah.
And then you're allowed to drive it a second time, where the co-driver reads what he's written down back to the driver. That's it, finished.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to practice more than two times through a stage.
Yeah.
But that was a big step forward from no practice.
No, it sounds incredible. So from going from kind of the smaller rallies, and then going in 1968, you went for the London Sydney Marathon, which sounds like an incredible event, because I mean it took months and months of preparation.
I was a route driver by this time, and route group. you know, didn't really have a competitive car compared to the Lotus Cortina and these sort of things.
Yeah.
So we were usually just rallying the Hillman Imp. Mm-hmm. I mean, I won my class in the Hillman Imp. They had a class in Monte Carlo that all the cars got to Monte Carlo. And then the final night of the classification was any car under 1 litre was not allowed to go out.
Right.
And we were the only, we led the 1 litre class, which allowed us to go out in Monte Carlo 8 years in the trot.
Wow.
And so we were probably the only 1 litre car.
Yeah, it was fast enough.
Off on the road. And this was a great challenge for us to win that, and it was it was good value
for
Roots Group to advertise that. So that was good. But then when London Sydney was announced, everything in the country was pretty low in their, you know, industry and ambitions, and morale was pretty low, and they decided to run this marathon rally from London to Sydney. And we were fortunate enough to have a works contract with Roots Group to give us a car, and we decided to do it because we didn't have a race car, but we decided to build a car that was strong and reliable.
Yeah.
And the Hillman Hunter was the obvious one.
Yeah.
Because weight didn't matter; you were going to have to build things strong, so that you would be adding some weight to it.
Yeah.
And our budget for London City was £25,000.
Yeah.
And that was our budget for the year for doing all these other class-winning events.
Yeah, yeah.
So we decided just to throw everything in the pot.
Yeah.
And go off. And we started to test the Hilton Hunter. It was the obvious one to take because it was the right size.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very good engine, a 2-litre engine, which was actually made in Brazil.
All right,
a company who did modifications to race cars called Holman and Moody.
All right.
And they did a cylinder head for us.
Yeah.
And we managed to get a few more brake horsepower from that.
Yeah.
But high compression, that was a bit of a handicap because the petrol that we were using down through Bulgaria, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India was about 80 octane. So we did a cylinder head with low compression, and then we got to Australia. We put on, we had time in Bombay, we had 4 hours to prepare the cars for the Australian leg.
Yeah.
And so we drove the first leg with this bit of a slog. In the Hillman with the low powered engine, and because of the poor petrol, these other guys were struggling a bit with, well, reliability, really, pistons and valves and things like that. And I'm talking about works road cars. And we got to Bombay, put on our new cylinder heads and new bits on the car, and off we went across the
country
with a brand new competitive car.
Yeah,
so
that
helped us. And we were sixth when we got to Bombay. And by the time we got to Sydney, of course, it was a... these other guys had lots of trouble and managed to win it.
Yeah.
But we did the 6 months of the year before it was run in December. It started at the end of November. We were running this car at Bagshot.
All right.
A military testing track.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we ran the car into the ground. Something broke. We didn't just repair it.
Yeah.
We modified it that it wouldn't break, but of course that passes on the G-spot to another component. This is how we prepared the car.
Wow.
When we left London, apart from the overhead issue, we had a bulletproof car.
Yeah, yeah.
And away we went on London Sydney, and to be quite honest, it wasn't quite the slowest car, but it was a very strong, reliable car.
Yeah, yeah.
And that got us to Bombay without any penalties.
Yeah.
And then we we built our car in Bombay and off we went across Australia. We just annihilated the rest of them across Australia, including Roger Clark, Teemu Mäkinen, all these top drivers that were in their worst cars. And we with our Helm and Hunter
went past a lot.
Them all by
That's amazing. I mean, how long did it actually take to get from London to Sydney then? How many months was it?
It was 10,000 miles. 10 days driving and £10,000 first price.
Wow. So it's incredible.
We were 7 days from London to Bombay.
Yeah.
And then 3 days from Perth, 3,000 miles across to Sydney.
That's incredible. I mean, 1,000 miles a day at rally speeds is huge, you know.
We weren't aware of hurrying, but I mean, we weren't going through Nadjeri roads.
Yeah,
until we got to Australia, then it became quite twisty and but all the way from London to Bombay, you were bombing along fairly main roads.
Yeah,
but
the
handicap there was, or the problem there was, you're mixing with the local traffic.
Because you're not used to you being on the road, and that, and they drive quite slowly and probably quite dangerously as well.
But anyway, we all our additional work, and we were going to suffer from the low performance engine and car down to Bombay.
Yeah,
but we took all the good stuff down to Bombay by ship.
All right,
Then when we arrived there, 4 hours to spare, instead of a mechanic servicing us down the route, we sent them all to Bombay. We arrived in Bombay, everybody got on the car, and Bob's your uncle. We left Perth to cross Australia with a brand new car.
It's amazing.
And they said, what's going on here? These fellas must have a lot of serious trouble here. They're changing everything on the car. We didn't have any trouble. It was all a plan.
So it showed you that you're really very, very good for first class preparation.
Yes.
That's what helped you
No question about it. I mean, we it wasn't luck that we won.
Yeah. No, you outsmarted them. Yeah. You did the whole thing as much as driving.
So that was London, Sydney. And that, I must admit for myself, that we were at the end of the line as far as Roots Group were concerned. They didn't have a competitive car coming on. And me winning London Sydney gave me a lot of publicity. And I got quite a few good drives out of being successful with that one.
Yeah, because you were offered now, was it a drive with Mitsubishi? It was, I remember seeing that you were approached by, was it the boss of Mitsubishi Sports?
I was, I had a few things in before that. We did London, Sydney, and then I got a contract with BMC.
All right.
To drive Minis and 1800s, which we used in London, Sydney. And there's one big rally in Australia called, like the RDC of the UK in Australia, is a Southern Cross rally. BMC left one of their cars from London, Sydney, in Sydney to be used locally. And they invited me out to drive that in this rally, and we won that. That goes. And Mitsubishi from Japan were only rallying in Australia, apart from Japan. And the boss of Mitsubishi asked me to drive for them in 1972. 1968 was London, Sydney. 1969 I won it with the BMC car. 70 and 71 I was driving Minis, and in 72 they asked me to drive a Mitsubishi. So that was the start of Mitsubishi, and I rallied with Mitsubishi in Australia, the Southern Cross Rally, for I won it for the 4 years. And then we had a spell with Mercedes, and Mercedes came into rallying in 77 and pulled out in 1980.
Right.
So they were just having a wee bit dabble at it, in all over the world with them, especially South America. South America. And then in 1982, Mitsubishi said, "Right, we would like to look at Ramming in Europe, because they were quite successful in the events they did do, but it was only hand-picked events.
It wasn't
a championship. So I said, okay, I said, would I help them? And I said, yeah, we'll help them to set up a competition department over here, providing it's in the UK.
Because
I'm a farmer, I still got a farm to run, you know.
And
they said that they would go to advertise it with the dealers who were already selling cars in UK.
So, or in Europe,
they would go around all the dealers to see which one would want to take on this and build a competition department. And the one that got the job was an Austrian company. And this Austrian company was called Denzel, and they had some experience of preparing competition cars. So we did 2 years out of Austria, and I was still driving, and the car preparation was very poor. And Mitsubishi said to me in 1974, would I be interested? I said to them, if it's in the UK, I'll do it, but out of the UK, no. So in 74, they rang me in November 73 and said, we would like to change it back to UK and you run it. I thought, oh my God, I should get my mouth shut, you know, what will happen will then for a year? So we came back to the UK, and we started down in Essex. I knew a friend of mine who used to prepare the Ford engines for them, Terry Hoyle. He was moving into a bigger factory, and he was trying to sell the lease that he already had existing on the factory he was in. So I had to find someone rather quick. So I went into his building. We started Rally Art Europe, Mitsubishi Rally Art Europe. And then we went into a purpose-built factory. I did, out of Malden, because we'd overgrown that. And we moved up to Rugby. And we went into a purpose-built factory in Rugby. And it was then that we started doing two championships. We were doing the Middle East, the Southern Pacific Championship, and that was Indonesia and Hong Kong, Beijing, and the, all those events, and Australia, New Zealand, plus the odd European event. Then the FIA made a rule that if we wanted to compete in the European events, we had to do the whole championship. We weren't allowed to do
hand-picked
ones. So we then, as I say, moved to this purpose-built factory in Rugby. We employed, at one time we employed 140 people. We won the Manufacturers' Championship for the world in 1978. And we won the, Tommy Mackinnon won the Drivers' Championship for 4 years in the trot.
That's right,
And I was then stopped driving. I stopped driving in 1990, and, more or less to get really involved in managing this team. I did, you know, and then we went out and we hired who we thought was the best drivers. We had Tommy Mackinnon, we had Kenneth Erickson, we had Seymour Lampinen, we had, you name them. Alistair McRae, Colin McRae's brother.
That's right,
Well, a lot of good drivers went through our hands, but Tommy Mackinnon was the star.
Because he was four on the trot, wasn't it?
He won four championships.
But, did you ever have Richard Burns? That was one of the questions
Richard
I was
trying... Burns drove for me too. And Richard won the Safari, and he won New Zealand for me, and he won the RAC for me. And then, unfortunately, what happened was that he was driving for the Peugeot junior team. And I, Tommy Mackinnon was driving for me, and he was very expensive to pay. And the Japanese didn't like it too much, but I don't. So I had to look for a cheap second driver. And Richard Burns was just looking for somewhere to go. He would have gone just to drive the car. And that's not, I didn't give him much more than that. He joined our team, and he won quite a few rounds, and he was really, he was at his prime.
When
he won the Safari, won the RAC Rally. And Colin McRae was driving for Subaru. Ford came in to the championship, World Championship, based Malcolm Wilson's.
That's right, yeah.
So they went to Colin McRae and said, how much do you want?
Yeah.
Would you like, you know, and I'm not going to mention how much he got, but he drove, he moved from Subaru to Malcolm
Wilson.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
On a 3-year contract.
Mm.
Of course, David Richard from Subaru, he thought, oh, where am I going from here?
Yeah.
Richard Burns. So he came to Richard Burns, offered Richard Burns a big fee, and took Richard to Subaru. And it was then that I took on Armin Schwartz. And Francois Delacour. And that's where we went. And I must admit, we kind of went downhill from there. And then when we lost Tommy, Richard Burns became ill.
That's right.
And he stopped driving, and Tommy moved from me to Subaru. And we did all right after that, but Tommy was a superstar, you know. He was a Lewis Hamilton.
Yes, of the category. Yeah.
He was.
I think Britain had such amazing talent at that time, obviously with Richard Burns and Colin McRae, and it was such a tragedy losing them both in such a short period of time.
I was bouncing off one to the other. I was doing Dakar, I wasn't doing the Ramen, but I was doing Paris-Dakar
for
Mitsubishi for 8 years I did Dakar.
And that's a huge rally in itself, isn't it? I mean,
it's quite different. It's a bit like some of those other things that we're doing in South America and London, Sydney, you know, across the Sahara Desert. It was
Because and it's big trucks, isn't it? You see these big kind
of there was
different classes for it.
We were navigating by compass.
Really,
and by maps, looking at the colours of the desert.
Yeah.
And then in 1989, Jean Todt was running the Peugeot team. And they built a special car for it. Ari Vatanen and Shikameta and these guys. And they started running it, again navigating by compass. But at the end of 1990, they said, right, we're not doing it. It was a French team, French event. We're not doing it unless we're allowed to use GPS. So they started doing GPS in 1991.
Yeah.
I did my last run in 90. And I finished fourth. But from 1991, it took the fun out of it.
Yeah, because it's kind of telling you where to go.
The GPS was completely different.
Yeah.
And the guy sitting beside you that was just looking after the fuel or the, GPS was so simple. Because you weren't following roads. You were just going to.
I suppose points on the.
Points.
The
GPS, you would know what. Spotlight, or not spotlight, what do you call them on the desert?
Oh, I suppose certain. I suppose a focus of a particular area or something.
And you were just trying to get there, and you might come across a like the Chile Hills there.
Yeah.
I say, well, now how am I going to get over then? Because there's no roads. So you look for the low bit, and you headed for the low bit and went through and carried on.
That's amazing.
But it was amazing. But when it became, the navigation became by
GPS computer.
Then I never did it again. Mitsubishi did it a few times after that.
Yeah.
In fact, they were very, very successful with Paris-Dakar. I think they won it about 7 or 8 times.
How do you feel going on to the modern day rallying? I mean, it seems to be making a bit of a revival in recent years. It went through, I think, when a tar time maybe about 10 years ago, but it seems to be getting more popular again.
Rallying is becoming very popular, and it's getting better television than than it has done for years. You know, it took a big dip.
Yeah.
And I think it was lack of support from manufacturers.
Yeah.
And you know why that was? No television.
Yeah, I was surprised they would never cover it. Yeah.
You don't get a manufacturer to spend £2 or 3 million and get 9 for it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a big secret who won.
Yeah, yeah.
And what we did, when I was running the Mitsubishi team, Bernie Eccleston was controlling the television rights for FIA events, sport, Formula One, all that, and rally. And he said, we complained about not getting television.
Mm.
And he said, every organiser was responsible for televised, for filming their own event.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they'd give it to Bernie. Then Bernie would sell it to the television.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what happened was, if I'm running an event, I don't really care much about the filming of it.
Yeah,
We should do it. So the filming became very, very poor.
No
television company would buy it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was, so Bernie took it on himself. We, first of all, went to Bernie and he said, oh, I can't afford this. I said, well, we'll pay for it. Yeah. And there was 5 manufacturers at that time. I was the head of Mitsubishi, and Tim Richards was Subaru, Peter Ashcroft was Ford, John Thornton was Peugeot. Anyway, we all put £250,000 in it.
Mm.
And we took the money and we put it out to tender.
Yeah.
And we got the best tender we could from professional filming people.
Yeah.
So, right, you do a film of RDT Rally or Monte Carlo Rally or Australia.
Yeah.
And edit it, then give it to Bernie.
Yeah.
And Bernie has no excuse. He's got to present it, and all the television stations wanted it.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
We had a period like that, and then just after we packed up, early 1999, 2000, the manufacturer lost interest.
Yeah.
And they backed off paying us money. Yeah. And the film quality went down. And it just wasn't happening again.
Yeah.
But now, they're back onto the same, the same tack.
Mm.
A proper professional company is making the film
of
all the rallies,
mm.
and they're selling it to television. Eccleston's out of the ring altogether. FIA is not controlling it, and as you've probably seen on television yourself, it's gathering momentum again. And manufacturers are seeing some value from spending this money going rally. So it has. And the covering by helicopter and editing is really quite good.
Well, I remember even just a few years ago, in fact, probably about 10 or 15 years ago, when the Jim Clark rally was on locally, and they had great footage. It was the one when Seat was sponsoring it one year. And it became, I think it was part of the British Rally Championship. And it was great because Dunn's was opened up and they had the room in the castle grounds and they had all their showcase there and the shows came. And they had helicopters flying and I thought, wow, this would be amazing if they could do this every year, you know, to make it really stand out. And of course on some of these roads up near Long Formacus, I remember whistles blowing because they were struggling to get people off the road, all spectators, when the cars were coming. But
the Jim Clark rally became an absolutely excellent rally.
Yeah.
And as you very well know, it was the only closed road rally in the UK. And popular with everybody. But apart from the accident that eventually put a cap on it, you know, the manufacturer was starting to lose interest.
Because it
was not getting the television coverage that they need to justify. You see, to go and make it to film the Jim Clark rally, it would probably cost £1 million.
Yeah, to do it. Oh, yeah.
You
know,
you can't do these things without numbers.
Exactly.
Without people.
Yeah.
So it.
And helicopters and everything else cost money to do all these shots. Yeah.
But so it kind of dipped away, but I don't think we'll ever see it back again.
Yes, there were rumours that there's going to be a Reavers rally that potentially might come back next year.
Yeah.
That was the thing, hopefully to try and work with the opening of the new Jim Clark room.
Well, we give it our full support, and we'll do, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you see, when you get the law involved, the police.
Yeah.
Cleared it. It was nobody's fault but these guys. It was their own fault.
Yeah.
Everything was through the court.
Yeah.
And the local authority held their hand up, just hang on a minute. You know, we want to have another.
Yes, when they get involved, and it's
Douglas Never, you can talk over the room, that room. What a hassle they've had.
To get all that sorted out. And when you think you're investing into the area, it's going to do a huge amount for Duns, and they reckon that tourism could be up from about 5,000 to about 20,000 at least. You know, and I think more and more people will come and see it, especially when this car's on show and lots of interactive events as well that they're doing. And even when they did it a few years ago, when they did the Jim Clark celebration in Duns, I mean that was fantastic.
I did it once in my home in I had a heart attack after that, not on the event, but
A
week or two after the event.
Good reason not to do another one then, it's...
The car was going too fast for me.
It's super. I mean, thank you very, very much for talking. It's been fantastic. We've got a really good range from your early days right up to your Mitsubishi days as the manager of the Rally Art team. I remember seeing you on TV frequently being interviewed on Channel 4 and BBC One. Thank you very much. It's been fantastic to have you on the show. And to all our listeners, you've been listening to the Cardo Advisor podcast show with me, Hugh Hattrick, and my very special guest, Andrew Cowan. At cardoadvisor.co.uk, we can help you save thousands of pounds on your next new car or van. And we can also source second-hand cars as well. And we can save you money on car rental, whether it be in the UK and abroad. Just click our rental link on the website. And we'll give you a free gift if you trade in your car with We Buy Any Car using our special website link. So go to the website now and see how much you can save. And it's back to the show. Thanks for listening. For more information, go to cardoadvisor.co.uk and you can see all the special offers that we have on the website. And remember, we have our YouTube channel, which is at Hugh Hattrick. And also, we have our podcast on Podbean, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Anchor FM. And if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to our shows. Or you can donate every month for just a pound. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.